Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, measuring risk. And the ultimate goal of this is to take you to the capital asset pricing model, but also show you some other metrics of risk along the way and some resources for data that you can grab that would be useful for investment purposes and for other purposes that you might have here at the university and in your careers. Now, before we do that, we'll have a quick look at the numbers, the screens that are showing here now. And as you can see, we have another up day. It's not a spectacular day by any means compared to some of them. But as you can see, there's that same pattern that happens so often. The Dow, the lowest risk portfolio, the Dow 30, is down just a tiny bit. That's flat. And then you have the S&P 500 that's up almost a half a percent. And then there's the NASDAQ plowing up almost 1.3%. So it's just that same thing over and over again, the risk return phenomenon. And now, as I had told you, oil is finding its feet again. It's back above $100 a barrel at 104, and it's pulling up. It had a bear morning. Do you see that spark chart? How it tried to come back down, but then it bounced and it came back up again. I mean, I've told you this before, you're always going to have some excuse, and everyone's got a reason for why things happen. Usually, there is a reason, but it's not the reason people are giving. In this case, I've heard a couple of stories this morning. Yeah, we are pretty sure that there is going to be a cut in the oil supply. Russia is going to be clamped down. We'll lose some of that oil. We also have some problems with oil that other supply parts of the supply chain. But as I've told you before, and this goes back to economics, the short-term pain of oil prices doing this is mitigated by the reality that this makes alternate energy resources more viable. And in the long run, this helps us move along. Whether or not you are an adherent of the concerns about fossil fuels and global warming, the reality is that we need to move on. Fossil fuels have been ruling the economy for a long, long time, and we can't bitch about all that they have done. And well, although we can gripe about what they've done to our environment. But it's time to move on, and this helps us get to the next technologies that you will see in your later lives, that your kids will think have always been there. Electric cars, geothermal, wind turbines, fusion reactors. That's another thing, too, that I should point out is that all of this talk recently, and you may have noticed that you see these news articles about fusion reactions now achieving break-even and sustained break-even. That is the result of a new push that has been going on. When I was a kid, we were talking about fusion reactors, and it was just not going anywhere. All of a sudden, here we are hearing about the reality of creating the first of those reactors in a real world. And if we can get those going by the middle of the 21st century, by the middle of this century, our energy problems are pretty much solved, as well as a few other problems that seem like they're not related to that. But that's down the road. But yeah, crude oil is going up. Bad news for the cost of fuel and the cost of transportation now. Good news for the future for us. Now, moving on, as you can see, metals have gotten a paddling. But the 10-year bond is down 4 basis points, which means that the price is up. So investors are moving to bonds. Now, I keep saying these things over and over again, and after a time, this becomes second nature to you to be able to think like this. And that's why it sounds repetitive, but I keep saying it. Here we have bond prices, bond yields going down, prices are going up. That means investors are buying bonds. Investors are also buying stocks. So they're kind of sort of playing both sides of it. Let's get some safe stuff like bonds, and let's get some risky stuff like stocks. But the metals are just not a go right now at all. Now, over on the other side of the Atlantic, London just was being pounded for most of the day over there. And just in the last few hours, it's climbed back up into positive territory, for what that's worth. And the Nikkei is also having a nice up day. Had a nice up day over there, too. So there is still a bullish sentiment out there. And the traders that I talked to, my former students and some of their bosses, they're actually in a fairly chipper mood right now. It's not like, yay, the whole world is wonderful, but there isn't a real sourness. There's not this, the end of the world is coming in there, in the way they talk right now. So it's not a massive bullish market, but it certainly is a market that is saying, well, it's not a terrible time. That must be taken against the yield curve. And as you can see, as of yesterday, it's still inverted, and it was 3 basis points. It was on the 15th, it was 1 basis point. On the 16th, it was 3 basis points. Yesterday, it was 2 basis points. No, it was 2 days ago. Yesterday, it was 2 basis points. So, yeah, we have an inverted yield curve. I had an interesting thing happen on LinkedIn. I had written an article and showed the yield curve visually where the inversion was occurring at the 7-10-year leg. And I said, this presages a recession. And I had a fellow, he was my student back in 2019 and in the spring semester, and he made this comment, which I can't tell whether he was being sarcastic or not, but he said something about, yeah, this is the same thing you said back in 2019 when the yield curve inverted. So I showed him a chart, and sure enough, 4 quarters later, there was a recession. It was a 2-quarter recession. It was a mild recession, and it was preceded by 2019, and I was teaching this at the time. I went back to make sure my podcasts were, I actually said that in my podcast. Sure enough, see the yield curve inversion? It started out, there you go, see it? That was a 2-3-year leg inversion. Usually, and don't take this as gospel, the closer in the inversion, the less severe the recession. That's just something that I've seen before. And the 7-10 worries me more than this one did. And yes, and I checked in the podcast. Yes, I did say there was a recession. And now over here, let me do something real quick here. GDP quarterly growth. Gross Bureau of Economic Statistics. Let's see if we can get a graph here of it. Nope, that's not going to do it. I'm going to need another one. One a little bit longer. Fred. Here we go. Here's Fred. I'm still not getting the one that I want. There it is. Do you see it? There was a recession right there. And it was a very tight one. See how small that gray band is? It was a short recession. It was only 2 quarters. But sure enough, I called it that we had an inversion at the beginning of 2019. And by the time we get to 2020, the economy was in a recession. And it was, notice again, it was a mild recession. And that goes along with what you saw here, that the inversion was in the short leg. It was a short leg inversion. So, yeah, this isn't a perfect predictor, but it's one of the damn best ones we have for seeing a recession coming at us and getting ready for it. And I will talk next week when we get to some more about portfolio control theory and practice. I'll show you how you defend your portfolio if you think there's a recession coming. You don't run for the hills and scream like a chicken, like Chicken Little, but there are wise moves you can make looking at yield curves and other economic data and creating a portfolio that will be fairly robust to a recession. You can actually do okay in a recession. So this is not just abstraction that I'm giving you here. Anyway, enough of that. And that was Yeehaw Finance. Now, I want to talk for a second here. Risk aversion. Now, most people are risk averse. It's just the way we are. But not everyone is risk averse. Some people actually love risk. Let me try to give you an example. How you could tell. Suppose that you had bet. You flip a coin, a fair coin. Now, the payoff heads, probability up here, payoff. Now, a heads, the probability, if it's a fair coin, would be 0.50. And if it pays off, you get $1. Tails, also, of course, if it's a fair coin, has a 50.50%. Add them up, you get one. It has to be one or the other. And in this case, you would get nothing. Now, the expected value of the payoff would be simply 0.50 times $1 plus 0.50 times $0. So the expected payoff to this game is 50 cents. Risk aversion. Risk preference. Now, if you are risk neutral, you would be willing to pay 50 cents for this game. If you are risk averse, you would be willing to pay less than 50 cents, but not 50 cents. If you are risk preferring, risk loving, you would pay more than 50 cents for this game. It's a very simple test, kind of a stupid test. But it gives you an idea of what we mean by the idea of risk aversion. Risk aversion, which most of us have to one extent or another, is simply the concept that we would not pay as much as the expected value for a game. We have to get a juicer. We have to get something. In other words, the risk-free rate would have to be more than zero. Buying a treasury bill, which is going to pay $1,000 in 1 year, we would not pay $1,000 for it for two reasons. One is the opportunity cost of consumption, but the fact that even if it is a risk zero, we are not going to pay $1,000 for it. I could give you, it'd be simple. I'll pay you $1,000. In 1 day, if you give me $1,000 right now. You probably wouldn't do that, would you? Yeah, I'm good for it. Come on, really? You know? You see, there is this, we want a juicer. In other words, the risk-free rate is positive. We would certainly hope that it is. Greater than 0%. So now, I've mentioned this before, and I don't know if I've mentioned it much in this class, but in a lot of my classes, and in math and physics and in upper-level finance, you get these complicated formulas. They're a mess. I mean, they're just huge equations. And you think to yourself, really? It's easy to make mistakes in those. But oftentimes in those equations, there are these structures that just keep showing up over and over again. The same, add this, subtract that, whatever. And if you take advantage of that fact that these recurring formulas are there, or recurring little snippets are there, we can make our life easier. Here's one that we're going to use today. The market premium. And this is over risk-free, to be technical about it. All this says is this is a little bit of a snippet that has use for us. And I usually designate that by an RMKT, I think the book does, or another way you can designate it is by R-MKT. But this thing is the expected return to the market portfolio, MKTP, minus the risk-free rate. In other words, you take a world portfolio and you subtract the risk-free rate, and that's a premium, that's a juicer. This is how much we expect the world portfolio to pay us above and beyond the risk-free rate. Put another way, you, sir, you graduated from high school. You did great. Well, you know, there were a few incidents, you know, along the way, but we got the bail money together for you. But the thing was, though, that you could have quit right there and gone out and gotten a job at McDonald's. $10 an hour. Okay, some $8 an hour, but $10 an hour. But instead, you decided that you were going to go to college. That's a risky proposition because there's no guarantee you're going to get a good salary coming out of here. Lord knows we have a lot of majors who have that happen. But you were willing to take that risk, that additional risk. Think of the market premium the same way. It's how much extra you expect to get for bearing a risk that you didn't have to take. That's the market premium, over risk-free. And you're going to see that again in this class. It's the reward for taking the risk of the market instead of taking no risk. You see, you could save money, buy treasury bills, huge piles. That's what you could do with all your money, put them into treasury bills. You would never have a risk. You would get this little tiny return your whole life. But if you don't want to do that, you can invest in something riskier, like the world portfolio. And that's all that does is say the extra juice that you get by taking a risk instead of no risk. That's all there is to that. Now, I'm going to go through a couple, all the measures, the metrics again, of risk. The classic is, of course, okay, risk measures. The classic is, of course, is the standard deviation. That's total risk, the spread. It is not what we really want to do in finance, at least in most parts of finance. However, standard deviation is very commonly used in other parts of business. It really is. I mean, in some courses in corporate finance, I show all of these different ways you can measure the different types of risk, business risk, financial risk, operating risk, and those we use sigma for those. It is very important. It's very popular. And in other sciences, that's the one you always use. However, there is a problem with sigma. Sigma is, let me go on here. Sigma is scaled to the size of the operation. So in other words, you could have two companies that have very similar risk patterns. They could look very similar to each other, but because one has numbers that are in the hundreds of thousands or the single millions, its standard deviation would be a much smaller number than this, even though they had the same spread. a company that had revenues in the hundreds of millions or billions would have a standard deviation that was enormous compared to the small company, even though they have the same total risk. So we have to go to another one. It's actually kind of a useful one. And you'll see me use it. I think I already showed you how to do it earlier in the course, and I'll do it again here. But take the standard deviation. This is the standard deviation. This one is called the coefficient of variation. It takes the standard deviation and scales it by the average of the expected value, x bar. That brings everything down to the same number scale. The odd thing about the coefficient of variation, standard deviation will be in percent if you were doing percent returns. Coefficient of variation is a little bit odd. It's a pure number. The percents cancel top and bottom, so it's more like a pure number. And it's actually useful that way. Pure numbers are a nice thing. Okay, that's one. Now, there's another one that is very popular in mutual funds. And, I mean, I personally hate the thing, but it is so popular. It's called the Sharpe ratio. I swear, if you look at mutual funds, they will always report the Sharpe ratio. Return to the portfolio minus, well, let me put it this way. To the portfolio minus the return. Sometimes they'll use the return to the market portfolio. Sometimes they'll use the risk-free rate, and they divide that by the standard deviation. They bring it up in the book, and they ask you a question or two about it. It's just, they give you the numbers. Just plug them in. Now, what I don't like about it is it's using total risk, standard deviation, instead of only the non-diversifiable risk. But it is like a standard. Well, what's the Sharpe ratio? Well, hell, I didn't calculate it. Well, you should have, because that's what we use. Okay, whatever. There you are. I mean, it's one that's out there. And there are other ones, too. There are some really creepy ones, and fortunately, your book in this course doesn't show them. In other courses, you'll see them quite frequently. But the one that is the classic for us is this beta. Beta is just a scaling number. It is a magnifier. So in other words, if I take that risk of the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate, that market premium over risk-free. When I apply beta to that for a stock or a portfolio, it shows the magnification or demagnification of this stock's non-diversifiable risk. Let me show you. Suppose that the world market portfolio right now has an expected return of 8%, and the risk-free rate is 2%. Then the market premium over risk-free would be 8 minus 2%, which is 6%. In other words, that's your extra juice for taking the risk of the world portfolio. That's your extra juice. Beta just shows you whether it's magnified or demagnified for a given stock. So in other words, if I were to tell you that the beta is 1.5 on a stock, that would mean that's the juice that you would get on that, 9%. On that stock, it will magnify the market premium by 150%. Suppose I told you that the beta of a stock was 0.5. Then in that case, it would demagnify the risk of the market premium by down to half of the world. So in other words, if I were to look at a stock, and of course I delete, let's do something easy here, like MSFT. Oh, come on, really? I put it in the wrong slot. MSFT. Am I on crack? What's going on here? Well, let's try it. Finance.yahoo.com. Microsoft, MSFT. There we go. This says that if you have Microsoft in a well-diversified portfolio, it will demagnify the world portfolio's market premium to 91%. Take one like this, AMD, American Micro Devices. This one would magnify the market premium over risk-free by 85%, 185% of the risk of the market premium. So in other words, if it was at 6%, then this thing is going to juice it 185% in a portfolio. That's all this does. I'm building up to what's called a capital asset pricing model here. God, that's a scary stock. If I were to look at one like Bed Bath & Beyond, BBBY, that would magnify the market premium over risk-free to 156%. That's how you read a beta. But that means that it has to be in a well-diversified portfolio to do that, but still, there it is. If I were to take one like, oh, here's one, AGG. This is a mutual, this is a bond fund. It is considered the perfect bond fund. It's like, if you're looking at bond ETFs, bond funds, they almost always will tell you, well, this compared to the AGG, it's like, it's what we call a benchmark fund. Watch this. The heck is the stupid, did they stop showing the beta of it? Oh, there it is. Look at it. It is exactly a market portfolio's risk. That's exactly what it is. In other words, it will perfectly, 1.00, it will be magnifying. It magnifies 100, and that's it. Another one that does this is the SPYD, S-P-Y-D. Nope, SPYD, S-P-Y. Yes, there it is. Again, see the beta is perfect one. That means it is market portfolio. It is a market portfolio. So if you wanted to invest and you didn't want to be aggressive or defensive, you can't go wrong just buying a share of the SPYD. But if you wanted to go further than that, well, if you want to do something more than that, well, you could do that as well. I can't believe I, well, let me leave it like that for now. What is the expected return to a portfolio with, let's say, N stocks in it? N could be 1, 2, 5, whatever. Yeah.
I had a question.
Go ahead.
I was looking at the stock market and I noticed that betas were sometimes negative. I didn't understand.
What was what I do you remember, were you the one who asked me about that the last after last class. Someone asked me, is there betas that are negative? Yes. What they do, let me show you one real quick here. As a matter of fact, I should have done this anyway, and I politely avoided it until you dragged me back to it. AU. It's a gold. The beta is slightly negative. Now, what in the world does that mean? I found one, and I can't remember what the heck it was. Was it a sprot? I can't remember what it was. GFI, was it? No, it wasn't GFI, AU. Maybe it was KGC? No, I'm trying to remember what it was, but there was, here it is. Gold, was it gold? Now, you notice where I'm looking. That wasn't what I wanted. I wanted gold, G-O-L-D. Gold. Barely positive. Okay, here's what it means. These are called contrarian stocks. They move against the market. If the market goes up, they go down overall. And the beta is doing the same thing. It is with a negative. Where was that one I just did? AU? This one actually swings a little bit against the market. Again, they're called contrarian stocks. You buy these if you are a persistent bear. There are even mutual funds and ETFs that are contrarian. You buy those if you think the market is going to go to hell. Because generally, metals like gold go up when the market goes down. So they have naturally negative betas. And they're out there. And in fact, if you took a portfolio management course from me, like 242, sometimes if you've got a portfolio that you are beginning to get a little worried about, let's say it's got a beta of about 0.8. And you don't like that beta, there are a couple of things you can do. One is you can start trimming off the higher betas and put lower betas in. But a way to do it a little bit harder is to actually put in a contrarian stock or two. That's sort of like, that's a counter effect on the whole portfolio's overall risk. If you want to do it aggressively, you've got a nice portfolio with betas between 0.6 and 1.0, and you don't want it to really be that high. Well, one way you could do it is just throw in a contrarian, like this one. And it's sort of like it's like a smoothing agent. It's sort of like water and whiskey. It takes down. It doesn't really water down. The proof of whiskey doesn't change when you put water into it, but it doesn't get you drunk as fast if you have water in your whiskey. That's about the best way I can describe it. But contrarian portfolios, contrarian mutual funds are out there, and you can grab those if you want. I'm just curious here about something. Let me do SQQQ. Where the hell is the beta on that? There we go. SQQQ is an ultra short. It is a bet against the bulls. It is a hard, look at that beta. This is one that I've used before to make some money. If I thought the market was going to turn downward hard, I would buy this. Now, that's asking for trouble because you've got a negative magnification of 228%. And that is hardcore territory. But, if you think the market's going to go down, you just grab yourself some SQQs and ride them for a while. Don't ride them too long because this thing is fickle as heck. The market, as you've seen, everyone thought the market was done. It was over. So everyone was grabbing SQQs and a few of the other ones. There's one, UDAO. It's a bet against the Dow Industrial Average. My God, they held it too long. And then sure enough, as you saw earlier this week, the market goes up like a bull. They got creamed on that one. At least I can say I didn't do that something that stupid. But anyway, beta is our go-to measure. Yeah.
I had another one. So I meant to ask this a couple weeks ago, but in the exam, the question on Starbucks was like, is this a high dividend, low dividend, or medium dividend? I wasn't quite sure what the response was to that question. I think I might have gotten it wrong.
SBUX. I don't know if I said it was gave you the choice of medium, but 0.90, it's less than the world market volatility. Well, the market premium over risk-free volatility. So that would mean that it is a slightly defensive stock. And I see the P.E. ratio below 30. That tells me the same story. It's a somewhat defensive stock. In my judgment, Starbucks, I don't know. Look at this. I want you to look. I can't. Darn you. I wish you wouldn't do this to me. It just pisses me off. Do you see this, these declining, this massive drop right here? Do you see this dropping hard like that? That's a very nasty neckline. And if Starbucks doesn't break that neckline within the next, say, 2 to 3 weeks, that one is one I would stay away from. I would even short that stock for a while. I would buy put options because that is such a steep decline. Do you see how you were getting a warning here? Do you see how these were dropping, this neckline was dropping, and you had declining, but then it fooled you. It had a period where the lows were rising, but the problem was that the tops were not rising with it. So that was a warning right there. This is in for a drop. And so the next thing that I would say here is if it can't overcome this nasty neckline that's forming this way, within the next 3 weeks, that's something you just get the hell away from for a long, long time. Now, why do I think that in this case, Starbucks is getting out of Russia? Russia was a decent market. It's just basically losing that revenue. Starbucks is also going to a couple of radical new innovations that market, that people in that industry are saying, the analysts are saying is a bad idea. It's going to go to a no paper cups, no cups in their stores. And I don't think people are going to like that. People are going to say, no, that's not good. If we have to bring in our own cups to get Starbucks coffee, that is a bad move. So there are fundamentals looking at what it's doing, as well as the technicals, what the necklines are telling us. And they're both telling us that we might want to keep a real careful eye against this. Go ahead.
So this would be a large dividend or a small dividend?
That's a big-ass dividend.
Oh, okay.
See, they are making $3.70 a share. They are giving back to their shareholders $1.96 per share. In other words, their dividend ratio is over 50%. They could keep some of that dividend and plow it back into their operations, but that's not what they're doing. They're giving it back to you folks. What that tells me when a dividend is that high is the company can't think of anything to do with its own money. So it's just going to give it to you and say, here, figure out what to do with it. If I see a company that pays a very large dividend, well, that's wonderful for the old people who get a dividend check in the mail. But as far as long-term prospects for the company, it's basically saying Starbucks is saying, look, we're old now, we're tired, we don't have anything new, we got nothing. So here's your money. You go play with it. Yeah. What that tells you is that if I bought Starbucks right now for $87.10, bought a share of it, I would get a dividend of $1.96, which means that I am automatically getting 2.37%. It's sort of like a passbook savings account. I put $87.14 in the bank, and I will get a 2.37%, not guaranteed, dividends are never guaranteed, but pretty sure that I'll get that. Now, if it goes up in price, I get a capital gain too. But that 2.37% is sort of like, well, I know at least I'll get that back from this stock. I've spent $87.20 on it, and at least I'll get a 2.37% return. Now, if the stock goes up in price, I get a capital gain too. So you can see that the dividend yield is important to investors who don't want to speculate on capital gains. it's definitely important to them. Now, also interestingly enough, as a general rule, the higher the dividend, the lower the beta. Because essentially, it's not taking risks with the money that it's making. It's just giving it back to everyone. So in a large sense, look at a company like, for example, Amazon. Amazon, if I said, what is Amazon's dividend policy? The answer is not, it has no dividend policy. Its dividend policy is, screw you, we're keeping the money. And as you can see, the capital gain is just insane, possibly insane. Amazon is still growing. I'm surprised that they haven't offered two-day delivery to the International Space Station yet. But as you can see, no dividend, and see the beta? It's higher than one, because it's taking the risk with that money that it made for you by not giving it back to you, plowing it into the company instead on your behalf to grow the stock price. It's not a perfect rule. Don't get me wrong about that. Look at, let me show you one like Ford. Now, here is kind of an exception to the rule. However, you see the beta is very high, 1.12. It's an aggressive stock. But notice that dividend, it does have a dividend, but that is a really small percent of the earnings per share. It made $4.45 per share for its shareholders, but it's giving the shareholders back only 40 cents of that. So it's keeping most of the money for growth of the company. Hence, that's going to lead to a beta that's a little bit above one. It's a little riskier. We're letting Ford put the money back into the company to grow the stock, and there's no guarantee. That's the riskiest thing you can do, is let the company have its own money to play with and try to build something that actually works for once, like a Ford never did. Oh, sorry, I had some Fords. I have dark visions. I was in the time, if any of you know what the Ford Pinto was, I had one. You know what, you do know about the Ford Pinto, famous, you know, if you hit it in the back, it would explode. It was really cool. I mean, if you were trying to get up a hill, you have someone hit you, you'd get up the hill. But anyway, enough of that. Where the hell am I? Okay, let me finish this off. Here is our capital asset pricing model. It says that the expected return to a stock or to a portfolio is going to be, now you're going to get the risk-free rate. Nothing is going to pay less than the risk-free, because no one will buy it if you can buy a treasury bill instead. So you're going to get the risk-free rate, plus you're going to get that magnifier, beta S, on the market premium over risk-free. That's all it's saying. That's all the capital asset pricing model says. It is so simple, it's stupid. If you remember from a long time ago, Y equals MX plus B, this is nothing but a stupid linear equation. Beta is on this axis. The risk-free rate is the y-intercept. The slope of it will be the market premium over risk-free, and a beta of 1 . That's the capital asset pricing model. That's all there is to it. So in other words, you say, okay, what's a beta of 0.5? I can look at it right here. What's a beta of 1.5? I can look at it right here. That's all CAPM does. It tells you what you should expect to return on a stock or a portfolio in a well-diversified portfolio. That's all it does. It's nothing grand. Do know this, though. This is called the securities market line. The securities market line. And it's always moving around, at least somewhat. So, for example, if this is the securities market line at some given point in time, it's got a beta 1 and a beta 0. That's your anchors for it. Now, if inflation kicks in, the whole securities market line skids upward. Risk-free rate goes up. The return to the market portfolio goes up. It all lifts up. So in other words, this inflation we're having now, that's not why the stock market fell. Inflation's actually pulled the market upward. Another thing that can happen. If this is the original line right here, if investors become more risk averse, they start getting scared, that can have a nasty effect because the risk-free rate wouldn't change because that's risk-free. But if they get more averse, then the capital market line swings upward like that. It pivots. So in other words, the expected return, the higher the risk, the more the expected return has to be to induce investors to invest. If investors are getting happy and they're not scared of the market, then they don't need as much so that they don't expect as much for their returns on stocks. Now, there are all kinds of ways that this line can swing around, but know that the two very important ones are if inflation hits, then the whole securities market line skids upward. So every stock has to have a higher expected return to compensate for the inflation. But if it's just a matter of investors getting more risk averse, well, that will cause the riskier the stock, the more it has to pay. And a lot more. That's pretty much the whole thing there. I'm going to do a little bit more on Monday, and I will have a surprise quiz for you on Monday as well. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.